This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Gardening expert Jenny Rose Carey will be along later this hour to talk about what we need to do to prepare our gardens for the cold weather ahead. We'll also hear from Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman. His listening tour on recreational marijuana is over, and he and Governor Wolf feel the time is right to legalize recreational pot. But we begin with a look at racial bias in policing as state and local governments increasingly move to implement policies to counteract discrimination. It came as something of a surprise to learn that 7 years ago, Pennsylvania's state police department stopped collecting data on the race of those who have been pulled over by state troopers. Pennsylvania's police department is one of 11 state law enforcement agencies in the U.S. which do not gather information about race during police stops. And we wanted to know why, particularly in light of recent stories like that of Rodney and Angela Gillespie, an African-American Chads Ford couple who were stopped by a young white trooper late one night near their home for an alleged minor traffic infraction over the summer. Rodney Gillespie was pulled from his car and handcuffed as his wife and 17-year-old daughter watched terrified. The Gillespie family is considering a lawsuit. As always, if you'd like to weigh in, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Daniel Simmons Ritchie is a reporter for Spotlight PA, which is a collaborative newsroom producing investigative journalism for Pennsylvania. Welcome to Radio Times, Daniel.
Hey, good morning. Good morning.
So in 2012, during the administration of Republican Governor Tom Corbett, Daniel, a decision was made by state police to stop the collection of data regarding the race of those who are pulled over by state troopers. Do we know why?
So that is a great question. Mary, and that was kind of the central question of our reporting. We found out they weren't collecting this data, and we found out they stopped in 2012. And basically, they told us that they gave us kind of two explanations. The first explanation, what they told us initially, was that, well, we were collecting this data, and it basically showed no evidence of racial bias, so we stopped collecting it. And the second explanation was, well, it was a bit too expensive. And so both of those, we bounced those off a number of policing experts, and they're both a bit difficult to understand. To target the second explanation first, the cost. I mean, this wasn't a very expensive program. This is a department with a budget of about $1.3 billion a year, and this program cost about, I think it was around $160,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a lot of money. And the second thing is the explanation why we don't have any evidence of racial bias. Most policing experts we spoke with were, A, skeptical that that was probably the case. But even if you assume it was, even if you assume PSP was doing a really thorough analysis and really just saw no evidence of racial bias, it kind of begs the question, why would you stop collecting it? As one policing expert put it to me, if you have a few good years where crime is low, do you decide to stop measuring crime? You know, like, why would you not want to know if conditions change in terms of racial bias among your officers? So that's kind of what we got. But the thing is that the commissioner at the time, Frank Noonan, told us that he didn't really recall the decision. It may have been made by someone lower in the totem pole. And PSP also told us that they didn't really have any written records of why the decision was made.
Have we heard from the current state police commissioner or the union on this?
So the commissioner declined to be interviewed by us. And the union also declined to be interviewed and basically redirected us back to PSP. We don't really have that much more information beyond what they've given us. In terms of those two explanations.
Daniel, the intersection of race and policing, you know, has been a huge focus of discussion in recent years. The absence of this data over the last few years can make one wonder whether there's a larger story of a state police and minority groups in Pennsylvania, which hasn't been told. Has there been reaction from civil rights groups?
Well, we spoke with the ACLU, which was, of course, very concerned about this, and they actually have a lawsuit right now against PSP alleging racially biased conduct towards, I believe it's Latino drivers.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say there is concern. And in fairness to the PSP, maybe the data shows, if they're still collecting, maybe it would show absolutely no racial bias. But if they don't collect it, we don't know. And unfortunately, that it kind of just raises questions. Why would you not collect it? Do you have something to hide?
Yeah.
And that may not be the case at all, but we just don't know.
So even as we don't know, this could possibly affect efforts to improve relations between police and the communities they serve. Is that a takeaway that you've pulled from this reporting?
That's definitely something the policing experts we talked to told us. They said, this is a great way to, if you collect this data, it's a really kind of good faith effort. It shows the community, particularly communities of color, like, look, we are monitoring this, we care about this. And if you don't collect it, it unfortunately can show the opposite. I think that's definitely fair to say.
Don't know if you have this info at your fingertips, Daniel, but is there data being collected individually by municipalities and counties in Pennsylvania?
So that is a terrific question. And the Philadelphia Inquirer actually had a terrific story on this about, I think it was 2 years ago. It focused most specifically on the Philadelphia region. And the short answer is that it really depends municipality to municipality. Some do, a lot don't. And this, I think, generalizes across the country. Most large municipal police departments collect this data, some don't, and I think if you get to the smaller departments, a lot don't. And I think a few states may have laws in place or rules in place that basically require all departments to collect it. But in a nutshell, in Pennsylvania, it really varies from department to department.
So state police say they will resume collecting data regarding race next year. Guess this can't happen immediately?
Yeah, so that was to the department's credit, about 3 days before our story ran, so we basically presented them with our findings. You know, we called up every state police department across the country to find out how many other state police departments weren't collecting this data. And as you said at the top of the hour, at least, 11 state agencies don't collect this data. And PSP was by far the largest. I mean, they're a big state police agency. They're actually the third largest in the country. And so when we presented them with this information, they, just before our story was published, they said, look, okay, we'll start collecting it again in next year. I guess in fairness to them, it probably does take a bit of time to develop this, a new collection system. They have to figure out what to collect, how to collect it, where they'll store it, that kind of thing. And I don't have a good feel for all the kind of logistical implications it has in trying to resume collection. But yes, that's what they told us, that they'd need until next year until they could start collecting it again.
And again, in the look that Spotlight PA took at how statewide law enforcement were operating across the country in collecting data about race, sometimes certain information is collected at a stop, sometimes it isn't, depending on what happens at the stop. So I guess there's got to be a framework that has to be put into place.
Yeah, and that's an excellent point, and something that's kind of easily lost. In this conversation, that it's not just collecting the data. As policing experts we talked to said, it's about making sure you're collecting comprehensive data, because to actually analyze this stuff, it's pretty complicated. You have to do some pretty complicated analyses to figure out whether there is racial bias at play or, you know, some other quite reasonable explanation for why officers, say, might be pulling over drivers at higher rates. You have to be making sure you're collecting it basically in every circumstance that a driver is pulled over. And you have to collect good data about what happens after that stop happens, you know, whether a search is conducted, what kind of search, whether contraband is found, ideally what kind of contraband is found. There's a variety of best practices, and certain state police departments follow this better than others. And so the hope among the policing experts we spoke with is that PSP will have a very comprehensive program in place next year. But at this point, we really don't know what it'll look like.
We are speaking with Daniel Simmons Ritchie of Spotlight PA. And Daniel, we've got some comments coming in. Cynthia says, it's a well-known fact that black and brown people are disproportionately targeted by law enforcement in this country. If no documentation is on file to show this trend, then there is obviously no evidence to show this. Shame on them. Then an email from Morris, who says, as a resident of Philadelphia for 56, I guess that's probably years, every black person I know has given a story about treatment by the state police and stops for no reason. What is in place now at the State Police Department in Pennsylvania to help ensure that state troopers do not act with bias when pulling people over on the road, such as anti-bias training?
Yeah, I believe they do have anti-bias training, a number of training programs I think they've introduced in recent years, and that's to their credit. That's something I think it's fair to say we'd hope most agencies have in place. And they may have a few other programs, too, that aren't coming to me immediately. But they do have some efforts to prevent this kind of stuff. But the fact of the matter is the best way for us to really detect whether it's going on is to collect the data. There really, to my mind, I can't really think of any other real way you can monitor this stuff unless you're collecting really good data on it. So that's the kind of the major problem here.
Remind us of the racial profiling scandal in New Jersey of the 1990s and the fallout from that.
So in fairness, I'm not as familiar with that. I co-wrote the story with my colleague Angie Columbus, and she had a better understanding of what happened there. But I believe there was some kind of scandal in New Jersey that resulted in much stronger oversight of the state police agency there that involved stricter monitoring and analyses of the kind of data, this kind of data that we're talking about on traffic stops.
Yeah. You interviewed Christy Lopez, former official at the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department and now a professor at Georgetown Law. She says tracking race during traffic stops is also in the best interest of the troopers themselves.
Yeah, and that comes right back to what we talked about a moment ago, which is that really if, PSP says, and they may be completely correct about this, they say that we don't police with any kind of bias. But if you don't have the data, it's hard to back up, and it again raises these questions, particularly among communities of color who have a lot of reason to be suspicious of police conduct based on, history. So this is why it's so important. It shows that you care about the issue. And it shows that if you see anything amiss in the data, that you're really doing something about it. So.
We appreciate you stopping by for a little bit here with us on Radio Times. Daniel Simmons Ritchie, reporter for Spotlight PA. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Coming up in just a moment or so on Radio Times, Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman just wrapped up a lengthy listening tour in which he heard from Pennsylvanians about their thoughts on legalizing recreational marijuana. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Recreational marijuana is legal in 11 states and Washington, D.C. And if Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf and Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman have their way, the Commonwealth will be next. Fetterman has wrapped up what he's called a listening tour of all 67 counties, during which he asked Pennsylvanians whether recreational marijuana should be legalized. Fetterman says he found a majority of those he spoke with are in favor, and he and Governor Wolf now want the legislature to debate and consider the legalization of adult-use recreational marijuana. However, Republican leaders in the legislature, at least at this point, are saying no way. We'd like to know what your thoughts are. Send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman joins us now by phone. So glad you could be with us, John.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
So to start, tell us a bit about the tour and some of what you heard, pro and con.
Yeah, well, Governor Wolf asked me to have a conversation with Pennsylvania. And this is a topic that he suspected a lot of people feel very passionate about and want to talk about. So the only way that it made sense, I think, was to go to every one of Pennsylvania's counties and have that conversation. And that's exactly what we did. I did 67 counties in 93 days, I think. And really just the diversity of Pennsylvania's counties, you know, one that has 5,000 residents all the way up to Philadelphia, which is one of the nation's largest cities. So it was a very comprehensive, civil and very engaged conversation that I had across PA.
So there was immediate pushback to talk of legalization from Republicans in the General Assembly, the House and Senate are majority GOP.
I found much of it just measured and not unexpected. I mean, they've been clear that they're not there yet. But the idea that the governor came out for, and these were steps that virtually everybody agrees on, and that was decriminalization and expungement of small nonviolent marijuana offenses. You know, these are things that I can honestly tell you that I didn't receive any pushback from, even from those that weren't ready for it recreationally, and not one single Pennsylvanian. So if there's one out there listening to this show, please reach out that thinks that Pennsylvania, that cannabis should remain on.
I think we might have lost the lieutenant governor there for a moment. We are working to get him back. And again, we are talking about Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman's recent listening tour across Pennsylvania, in which he talked with residents of the state about the prospect of legalizing recreational marijuana. We're also going to be speaking with John about what he was just referring to, and that are some additional measures to decriminalize nonviolent and small cannabis-related offenses. And also, the Lieutenant Governor would like to see the expungement of past convictions of nonviolent and small cannabis-related crimes. So we will be getting to that momentarily as soon as we can get our line back to the Lieutenant Governor. I hear that you are back with us now, John.
I am. It was a technical glitch on our end here, and I'm completely back.
Glad to have you with us. And that is live radio, right? You had mentioned a moment ago about the measure to decriminalize nonviolent and small cannabis-related offenses, and that folks in the legislature might be more open to considering this.
Sure.
Tell us about that and why you'd like to see decriminalization.
Well, there's already some bills that had some BIPOC. In fact, one of them was sponsored by a Republican member of the House from Berks County. And there's another measure. These aren't controversial. I try to remind people that cannabis prohibition in Pennsylvania is a true minority position at this point to have. Everyone's moved on. And when you have things like expungement and decriminalization and removing it from Schedule One, these are all super high approval to the point of unanimous, especially on Schedule One classification.
So why decriminalize and why expungement?
Because I think it's a necessary step for those that aren't quite there recreationally for legalization to understand that this is not a substance that belongs in its current classification. This is not a substance that is worth jamming up people's lives on a criminal basis. This is not worth, with zero overdose deaths, zero documented overdose deaths. When we have an opioid crisis that takes the lives of 70,000 Americans every year, this is not, we have bigger fish to fry. That's what I hear. And also from law enforcement, too.
So there are criminal justice concerns.
Ridiculous criminal justice reforms. Everyone knows that people in communities of color are much more disproportionately impacted by the enforcement and the way that it can have an effect on your record, getting a job, getting a loan, housing, participating in your children's events at school. No one should have any kind of harm in that regard for something as small as this. And everyone's in agreement on that, Republican and Democrat.
So, John Fetterman, let's take a look at how other states which have legalized have fared and what Pennsylvania might learn as it tries to move ahead on legalization. You know, one of the concerns, you know, about legalizing recreational marijuana revolves around the effect that it might have on people who are underage. And as, you know, any parent knows, you know, if it's in the house, some kids are just going to figure out how to access it.
Sure.
You know, there are experts who say the teenage brain is in the process of developing. It's a real critical time. Teens shouldn't be smoking pot. You know, the teen brain and the adult brain are two different things, and that youth who use marijuana are less likely to graduate from high school. How do you address those concerns moving forward?
Well, again, I don't think anyone disputes that developing brains are susceptible to the effects of cannabis. And I didn't encounter one single individual, no matter how adamant they were for legalization, that thinks that legal age should be anything below 21. Didn't run into it. And this idea that some people conflate legal with harmless is completely specious. Of course it has an effect. Otherwise, people could smoke their lawn clippings for the same effect. You know, if you look at alcohol and tobacco, these kill hundreds of thousands of Americans every year. So this idea that simply because it's legal implies that it's harmless, nothing could be further from the truth. Okay. You brought up teenagers. When my children are that age, people ask me, like, well, you want your kids smoking? I'm like, no, I don't. And I'm going to have that conversation with them. But if they, like many other teenagers, decide to experiment it, I would want that cannabis to come from a safe, pure, tested source, not from who knows where, from who knows what, with God knows what's in it, as so many of our young people do today, and it gets it out of the black market. So that's the conversation that I had. So people's concerns are justified, yeah. But this proposal would take it and make it safe, regulated, and legal. And we would ask young people, you know, what's easier to get in your circle of friends, alcohol or marijuana? And every single one said, oh, marijuana is easy. Yeah. Alcohol, they card. It's a lot harder to get a hold of alcohol. And to that point of regulating it and making it safe and legal.
So, and looking forward as to which products might be regulated, you know, word that comes in from Colorado and Washington State, you know, with products like candies and cookies and drinks, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. Yeah. You know, we had a recent story here in Philadelphia last week. A bunch of seventh graders were sickened when someone brought in marijuana-laced Rice Krispies treats. You know, in Washington State, lawmakers tried and failed to curb the sale of pot-laced gummy bears. Are there certain products in hearing these stories that you might take a look at and go, ahead of legalization, how do we handle these? How might we handle these differently than other states have handled them?
We had a lot of concerns expressed by with edibles. This idea that you're putting a drug in a substance that is especially attractive to children. It's a fair concern. And dosing is a real question and a real issue. So edibles is certainly its own separate issue, and one that we heard loud and clear, and that again speaks to this issue of how critical it is to regulate it and make it legal, and because you just don't know what you're getting if it's just a free for all, and there's no control or regulation.
We have an email from Tommy who asks, have you already had discussions concerning how you will put the tax dollars for marijuana sales to use?
Well, I haven't had that conversation, but the people of Pennsylvania sure did. And not one single resident said, I think you should just throw it into the general fund. You know, that everyone wants it for very specific things like fixing up our infrastructure, you know, paying the, you know, property taxes, or public education. You know, this idea that it would generate a significant stream of revenue on an annual basis is attractive to some individuals, and they would want it going for a very specific objective, not just, well, just throw it in the general fund.
So what would the tax on recreational pot in Pennsylvania look like?
I don't know. That's a conversation that when the conversation advances to that point, the legislature would have to decide. I suspect that it would have to be on something that could work on our rural infrastructure, that could boost our agriculture industry in Pennsylvania. I don't know, but it would be a collaborative conversation with the legislature if and when we get to that point.
Because legalization in New Jersey and New York this year was far from a slam dunk. You know, efforts to legalize did not work. And New Jersey's
New York decriminalized, my understanding, and New Jersey's is imminent. And it wasn't a matter of if, it's a matter of when and under what conditions. And Illinois became the first state to legalize it through legislation. And I just want your listeners to understand that we can't put it on the ballot in Pennsylvania. That's unconstitutional. Okay. Pennsylvania doesn't allow for that mechanism. So people were frustrated saying, put it on the ballot. Like, well, you can't. And that's one of the reasons why I did the 67 county listening tour, is to give Pennsylvanians a chance to weigh in on it.
Well, back to Jersey for a moment. I mean, it may or may not be imminent. There was talk that Senate President Steve Sweeney might try to once again bring this up before the lame duck session of the legislature. And if not, then it would go before the voters late next year, I believe. But it was, you know, John, it was not an easy sell. He could not get all Democrats behind him when this bill was before the legislature earlier this year, and Governor Murphy campaigned on it.
Well, I would just say it's more on the specifics as opposed on the concept, if that makes sense. And the hard feelings between the Sweeney and Murphy are well documented. So there's a lot going on there that really isn't about legal marijuana. It's about other things. But Pennsylvania will be awash in legal recreational marijuana sooner than we might legalize it in our own state when New York goes online in New Jersey, and you know, certainly areas in the southeast and up in north. It's really would be a game changer for them as well too. And people have said over and over, like, well, why don't we get in on that? Why, you know, people want Pennsylvania cannabis grown in Pennsylvania farms, creating Pennsylvania jobs and generating Pennsylvania tax revenue.
So back to the candies and the gummies for just a moment. I just have a follow up question. Is this something that you would consider saying no way if you, as a lieutenant governor, do determine that this might end up being a health concern, a public safety concern?
Was that edibles? Did I hear that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Like edibles was a significant concern across the board. Absolutely. And it was responsible for a rise in emergency room visits where children ate too many gummies or what have you out in Colorado. It's definitely a concern. And it gets back to my point of this idea that legal implies harmless. The delivery mechanism, it could be something like Four Loko, where that people realize that this had to change and the delivery mechanism had to be regulated or discontinued. It's certainly part of a conversation in the bigger topic of is this right for Pennsylvania? But it was brought up time and time again from people, particularly parents.
Email from John: how will you test for marijuana to know if someone should or shouldn't be driving? Has that piece of the puzzle been put into place?
Sure. Well, there are tests and emerging technology in Canada and in California that are going to do just that. I think one thing that absolutely should change in Pennsylvania is this zero tolerance, that if there's any detectable THC load in your blood, that you're charged with DUI, even if you consumed cannabis 2 or 3 days ago, which nobody agrees is appropriate or proper. And now that CBD is legal, you could ingest a CBD product like gummies that might have a trace amount of THC, even though most of it's been removed, that could get flagged as well too for your job or for driving. And this zero tolerance creates a lot of undue hardship on individuals when the real spirit of the law should be to eliminate or minimize driving under the real influence, as opposed to having something in your bloodstream that has no measurable impact on your ability to operate a vehicle.
So as the research continues into these technologies, if I'm hearing you correctly, we're not quite there yet. should we have these technologies in place to detect whether somebody has an unacceptable amount of THC in their blood as opposed to a trace amount? Sure. You know, say as with alcohol, you have a breathalyzer. Should we have that technology in place before we legalize for
pot? Well, I mean, that's certainly a strong consideration, and people were concerned about driving under the influence and what have you. But I've also spoke to a lot of law enforcement officials, and those where there's a strong smell of marijuana in the car, or you know, there's pretty obvious signs of somebody who's under the significant influence of cannabis when they're pulled over. So I think the real issue is how do we find the exact marking metric of what is under the influence and what isn't, like alcohol. And I know things are moving along in that direction. And one of the things that would be helpful in getting to that point also would be getting it off Schedule One, because right now, currently, federally, you can't research it. You can't test it the way that it could if it were removed from Schedule One. And again, we didn't encounter one single person that says, no, cannabis belongs in that basket of truly dangerous drugs like meth or crack or what have you, heroin. That would be a real game changer if we could just even get that moved off Schedule One.
That might take an administration change, though, don't you think?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, in my humble opinion, one more reason to hope for an administration change, that it's just a common sense reform that would really open up the floodgates on innovation in the cannabis space and move us further away from the prohibition, which, again, I think most people would agree needs to change.
All right. It's been a pleasure. John Fetterman, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Okay. All right. Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, and we will keep track of that story here on Radio Times. Up next, Jenny Rose Carey is director of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's Public Garden and Nursery and the author of Glorious Shade. She will be along to talk about fall gardening. Lots to do, lots to talk about. Stay with us. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is WHYY in Philadelphia, Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are officially 1 week into autumn, and while temperatures in Philly, the Philly area, won't quite match the calendar until later this week, just the thought of cooler weather is heaven to many gardeners. In fact, I've heard some say fall is the best season for planning and planting, not just for cleanup. So we are devoting the rest of the hour to the possibilities of fall gardening. If you'd like to join us, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email along to radiotimes@whyy.org. Here to help us roll up our sleeves, figuratively anyway, is Jenny Rose Carey, director at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's Meadowbrook Farm in Jenkintown, and also the author of Glorious Shade. Welcome back to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me back.
So is autumn one of your favorites?
I like it because it's my birthday, but, you know, apart from that, I much prefer spring, to be honest. But it's a great gardening season, and yesterday, over the weekend, wasn't it lovely to be outside?
Oh, it was glorious.
Yeah.
On the one hand, there's a dying back in the garden, but on the other, we really see colors start to come alive.
Yes. I mean, really, you've got all your fall asters and goldenrods and wonderful, you know, the Japanese anemones are out. And then we, hopefully, if it hasn't been too dry, we'll see the lovely fall colors start to develop.
Yeah. So should we talk about cleaning or planting first?
Actually, let's take cleaning because okay. I don't actually like using that word.
Oh, you don't. What would you rather use?
Well, cleaning to me has a negative connotation. Yeah. It smacks of running the vacuum cleaner for a long time.
It feels like work.
Yes, it feels like work. So maybe we'll just call it editing or something like that. I don't know.
Okay.
But also, with the leaves, I mean, we tend to say fall clean up with the leaves. We use it. It's a real term. But I actually really try and get people to use their leaves more. So it's sort of part of the cycle of nature. So instead of, I know for many people, putting them out on the curb, if you have the township recycling, is great. It gets them out of your space and everything like that. But for so many of us, really, that's the organic matter that has to go back on our beds. And whether it's just a pile that you leave your leaves in, or whether you've got a smaller property and you put them in a black plastic bag and punch a few holes in, put them behind, you know, the shed or the garage or whatever, within a couple of a year or 2 years, you're going to have something that can be, the bag will be opened and you'll open it and you'll smell that sort of earthy smell. And you'll be able to just take it and tip it right on your flower beds. And it's just free compost, free, you know, soil enrichment and nutrients for your beds.
What about running the lawnmower over them?
Perfect. If you can run your lawnmower over them, as we know with our compost heap, the more you chop things up and get them into your compost heap, the smaller they are, the faster the microbes will get to it and the worms and all the other decomposers, and it will break down faster. So if you can chop them up with a lawnmower on your grass and then either blow them back into the beds, that's really the simplest and easiest one, especially if you have a more naturalistic area, like down the bottom of the garden where you really don't mess with it so much, around shrubs, around trees. You know, if you've got a sort of natural bed area, run them over there, or get a, if you've got a smaller property, you can use a leaf shredder, which maybe your whole group of gardening friends could share one, because, you know, they're about $100 and something, but you can easily put tub trugs of the leaves in the top, and it just uses a weed whacker string to break them up. You know, wear ear protection and eye protection, but, you know, it's basically low impact, no big sticks in those. Those are homeowner versions, you know.
To prune or not to prune?
It is a good time to prune, especially, I mean, if you remember, now we're so dry, but and that's really one of our biggest concerns right now. We had so much rain earlier in the season, we didn't even have to think about watering anything. But a lot of the trees have grown feet this year. So you probably have, if you have a path under a tree or a bench or something, you might need to just go in and cut just at the tip end of a node so it doesn't leave that funny stub. Use sharp pruning shears. Clean your shears in between going from, you know, cut to cut or tree to tree.
So you don't spread disease.
Yes, so you don't spread pests and disease. Yeah. We just use rubbing alcohol in a little, you know, you can just pour it on it or spray it on it or whatever, dab it on it. But, you know, apart from that, evergreens, you can prune those, you know, hollies and your shrubs around your house. It's a good time because you don't want to be doing it when it's too cold out. You won't get out there and do it, really.
And also there are concerns that once it becomes cooler, you don't want to encourage new growth, which
That's
then
right.
is. So at what point do you stop pruning?
Well, things like hollies, we cut those through December, partly to use them if you're doing holiday arrangements. You might as well use the things that you've trimmed off. But I think in this climate now, we don't really get that cold before, you know, the new year. So I feel like all the way through, at least until the new year, you're safe. And then sometimes we get snow, so it's not so easy.
So what does a nice, clean bed look like to you? Something that's been, all right, we're not going to use the word clean, edited bed, look like to you when all is said and done, when we're ready to say, okay, come on, winter.
So there's the whole, you know, debate about whether you do a lot of cleanup in the autumn or whether you do it in the spring. And if it's more naturalistic, I would leave things standing because you want the birds to have the seed heads. So things like your coneflowers, if they've still got things on, a lot of the prairie plants have seeds for the birds. My general rule is, you know, if you see it from the kitchen window and it looks ugly, take it out. I mean, you know, there's plenty of other things in your garden for the birds. But, you know, maybe consider planting more berry shrubs, like some of our native shrubs that have berries, like the winterberry holly, those sort of things. But in general, clean up what you think you're not going to have time to clean up in the spring, because the spring gets so busy. But if you're thinking of moving things, when we get some rain, which hopefully will in the next couple of weeks, that'll be a good time to move things. In the meantime, while it's dry, a good tip is to get some coloured string or something, tie it round the clumps of perennials that you want to move. So you just make a little ring of a string around the ones you know are too close to the front of the bed. Maybe if they got too big and you need to divide them. But it'll give you an aid memoir when you are doing a bit of cutback and neatening to, this is one I have to pay attention to. It's in the wrong spot, whatever. So it's just a little trick to remind yourself. But the well cleaned up or edited bed, I definitely would have a ton of bulbs under it as well. So we're getting to bulb planting season.
Okay. So before we get to bulbs, at what point, again, is it too late to move things? You say that the growing season, yes. I mean, or the warmth is extended a little bit. So really, November?
Yeah,
or
probably before Thanksgiving.
I mean, what if we get a cold snap?
It doesn't really matter. Even if we get a frost, and in this listening area, you could get a frost, you know, up in the Poconos. It could be coming within 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever. Or if you're down in Delaware, you might not get anything before after Thanksgiving. So, you know, basically the air temperature is less relevant than the soil temperature. So the soil stays warm. It's a bit like the ocean. The ocean stays warm. The soil stays warm for longer than the air. So even if you've had a cold snap, you're still, you know, you've still got time to do things. And also when you've got that first frost, that's when you're going to clean out your annuals, when you're going to let your dahlias, however you want to pronounce it, get hit by that first frost, and then leave them in the ground a week and then dig those up.
So bulbs, how do you know when you're buying bulbs that they're in good shape? And then what are the rules of thumb for planting them so they make a nice show as we're getting out of winter?
Good question. Okay, so when you're out shopping for bulbs, look for ones that are firm and not mushy. Don't buy them if they have like green or blue mold on them. It's a bit like at the grocery store. So if you wouldn't buy it as an onion that you're going to cook with, don't buy it as a bulb. Okay. If it's also you pick up the bag and it's light, that's not a good sign. They should be quite heavy for weight because they're full of water and full of all those nutrients that are going to make the flower for next year. And really when it, you can carry on planting, you know, really as long as you can get your shovel in the ground. And what was the other bit you were asking about? Sorry.
Well, just rules for thumb, rules of thumb for putting them in.
Okay.
So, I mean, fertilizing.
Oh, for the good show.
Yeah.
So I always like to see them packed fairly closely, especially if you're buying what they call the minor bulbs, the little tiny scillas, China doxas, those little cute, more woodland type ones. Usually I put them, dig one hole and put, 20 in a hole, 10 to 20 in a hole. They will grow and divide, but they're so easy to dig up and move later. With tulips, especially if you're doing them in a container, when you read the bag on the tulips, it says plant them 6 to 8 inches apart. That would look terrible if you're putting it in a container. Think of the flower show. Think of when you go to the horticulture, the flower show, and you see those bulbs packed in. You've got 20 in a little 6 to 8 inch pot. So that's, if you want a really good show, you're going to have to, you know, if you buy your front stoop, those things, pack them in. And you can also do what we call layering in a container where you put the biggest bulbs down the bottom. And then in the, if you imagine a 5 on a die, in that middle bit, you put the next layer and then the next layer. And you get a lovely packed container like that. And just make sure you have, we talk about fertilizing. So bone meal is good unless you've got dogs, you don't want to use it. But compost, again, on your beds, that is
plain
the key.
Plain old the leaves that you shred?
Yeah. Put those, and you can do 2 to 3 inches on the top because over the course of the winter rains and snow, that will break down and it will make your soil so wonderful if you do that every year.
So that's a good rule of thumb for beds in general.
Yes, beds in general. If you like them all cleaned up in the fall, then add your leaf mold or your compost back on top.
2 to 3 inches.
Say that again.
How many inches?
Oh, about 2 to 3 inches.
Okay. Email from Andrea. Can I compost old plants indoors without using composting insects like worms?
I think you have to have a worm bin probably inside. I know people live in apartments. I mean, if you have even a little deck outside, you could put some things in a bucket. But there are many of the municipalities have a green waste program, and I would use that. And then some townships, you can go and get that back again. It seems a lot of work, though, if you can do it yourself. So, sorry, it's harder inside, and the natural elements are needed to break it down, really.
Do you also like to work with annuals during autumn?
There are some annuals that you can add. You know, people like to add the fall cabbages and some of the grasses and things into containers. I think for me, I like to be more perennial at this time of year. Or to be honest, in our season, if we haven't had a frost, our summer annuals are still going, especially if you deadhead them and make sure you water them less often but deeply right now. So once or twice a week max, but water them until the soil moisture has gone really down deeply into the soil.
We'd had an email from Julia earlier who asked about leaving certain plants so that, not deadheading perennials, but leaving them up again so that wildlife can enjoy them over the winter. Any of your favorites?
Well, I think all of the ones, the cone flowers are really good. I love this really tall flower called a silphium, which gets about 8 to 10 feet, but it's a sort of prairie borderline plant, a border plant, but it the goldfinches love that. But any of the ones with a good seed head on, and try and go with natives as much as possible, but the native sunny loving ones, they love the asters, they love all of those fall blooming flowers.
Yeah. So we promised we'd get to the spotted lanternfly.
Oh,
talking,
yes.
You know, things that are non-native. So,
yep.
You know, we done a show on this earlier this year here on Radio Times. It is an invasive plant hopper. It's enormously destructive. It's capable of wiping out grapevines, maples, fruit trees, you name it. I live in South Jersey. Just got a notification on a network online site saying, I've seen one.
Oh,
I
no.
haven't seen it yet. But
yeah.
Have you seen it where you work?
Yes. So I live in Amber and work in Jenkintown, and both of those sites have the spotted lanternfly. The interesting thing is when you look at them en masse, I mean, I just can't imagine, you know, people are vacuuming up with shop vacs and things like that. It just creeps me out, to
yeah.
be honest. But this is the time of year you will see the adults. They're about an inch and a half long. They're sort of camouflaged against bark. And when they sort of fly/drift on the wind or whatever they do, hop, you see a red flash of their under wings. And people are worried about it, especially if you're a farmer. You're very worried about it because economically it's going to be harming many of our crops. They actually have what's called a stylus that sticks into the plants and sucks the juices out of the plant. And then some of it drips out and falls down below, and then you get the black sooty mold. And some of people might have seen that around their decks and things. It's disgusting. So, you know, from a aesthetic point of view, from a economic point of view, we need to be squashing those things. Get a very industrial size fly swat, a wiffle bat, you know, anything you can. Squash those adults, you know, and
look for the egg masses too.
Look for the egg masses. Yeah, the egg masses. They always say scrape them off with a credit card. I'm like, I am not using my credit cards to scrape this off.
What would you suggest?
Well, they say putty knife. I don't own one of those either, but you know, I'm going to find some sort of knife or something in my garden shed that has a sharp edge on it.
Yeah.
And the egg masses look like a blob of mud. It's not really like anything. It doesn't scream eggs at you. So look online for the pictures. You know, the Penn State Extension has a wonderful website that has all the details. And you know, they have all of the management. But the adults are out now. Try and squash them. I mean, if we all squash them, whether it's actually going to work, because it's a hitchhiker and don't move your firewood around, don't move anything out of the quarantined areas.
Yeah, there is some hope. Apparently there's a biopesticide that's on the market right now that researchers are thinking might be able to use against the lantern fly.
That would be great. That
would be marvelous.
Yeah.
Very quickly, we've got like 15 seconds left. So what is the mindset that we should use going into the garden in the fall? How do you do it?
Plan for next year. So just think what you're going to be doing next year before you rip everything out. Start making lists, start making plans of your beds. Even if you can't draw yourself a little bubble drawing of your bed and plan for all of the things that you're going to be doing next year in the garden.
And enjoy it.
Yes, definitely enjoy it.
Well,
thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Jenny Rose Carey.
Thank you.
Director of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's Public Garden and Nursery, Meadowbrook Farm in Abington Township, and the author of Glorious Shade, Dazzling Plans, Design Ideas, and Proven Techniques for Your Shady Garden. And as always, you can connect with us on social media at whyy.org. org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times.